Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a hearing in the Supreme Court in a case that has Senate Republicans challenging the White House over the President's authority to make recess appointments. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, joins us to discuss the 90 minutes of oral arguments in the Supreme Court that appeared to indicate a majority of justices were skeptical of the administration's use of the recess appointment power that has been regularly and routinely exercised by presidents of both parties. Then we'll speak with Eric LeCompte, who is the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crises. He joins us to discuss the Supreme Court's decision to hear Argentina's case against a predatory hedge fund known as a vulture fund and its connection to the new Argentine Pope, who has spoken out against this form of savage capitalism and has just appointed 19 new cardinals, many from poor and indebted third world countries. Then finally, with major corporations like Target and Neiman Marcus having just been hacked, we will speak with Peter Singer, the author of a new book, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. He is the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. We'll discuss how the Internet has become the new arena for communications, commerce, and conflict, and the competing agendas of the NSA, criminal networks, the Chinese and U.S. militaries, and the anonymous hacker group. Joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be with you.
And Elizabeth, you were in the Supreme Court today where in the 19-minute oral argument over whether or not the president's recess appointments will be overturned. What was your sense? Because what I'm reading indicates that there were, I think a majority of justices seem to be pretty skeptical of this administration's use of the recess appointment power.
I think you're right that a majority of justices did seem skeptical, but I would sort of qualify your statement by saying it's not just this president's use of the recess appointments power. It's presidents going back to George Washington who have used the recess appointments power and understood the recess appointment power in the same way that President Obama is. And this includes, in recent times, presidents from both sides of the ideological spectrum. We have Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and then, of course, President Obama and Bill Clinton. So if the Supreme Court were to find that President Obama's recess appointees are constitutionally invalid, that would be quite a remarkable shift from the way that the president's authority under the recess appointments clause has been understood since the time our Constitution was written.
Well, obviously, this has been going on, and the recess appointments have been used repeatedly and routinely by presidents of both parties. But the fact that Mitch McConnell was in the Supreme Court today, and this case, it really does appear to be pitting the Senate Republicans against this White House. So to that extent, it seems different, or at least a showdown of some kind.
Absolutely. You know, it really shouldn't be a partisan issue, but that's not to say that it isn't. It certainly has been become a very partisan issue in this case. As you said, the Senate minority leader, Mitch McConnell, had time in the Supreme Court today, and he argued strongly against the president's recess appointment authority in this case. And it sort of gets to a, I don't want to say narrower, but certainly a potentially narrower ground for the Supreme Court to rule in this case. So in this particular recess, President Obama nominated members to the National Labor Relations Board during a recess in which the Senate claimed to be not wholly in recess. It would have what are called pro forma sessions every 3 days. This is, you know, a total formalism. They would last about 30 seconds. You know, someone would gavel in, gavel out, essentially. And the Obama administration is saying, well, they were functionally in recess, and that they weren't conducting any business. They were dispersed to their districts, to their home states. But the Senate, and Mitch McConnell in particular, came in and said, look, it's up to the Senate to decide when the Senate is in recess. So the court could say, well, in this case, because of these pro forma sessions, President Obama could not make recess appointees, and then leave untouched sort of the underlying constitutional authority for the president to make recess appointees when the Senate is truly in recess.
So how different was this White House's disregard for this pro forma kind of stunt where they gavel them in and gavel them out in a matter of seconds when there's nobody around, everybody's in their district that's clearly not operating, yet technically they're arguing it is? Have other presidents done recess appointments under these same conditions?
Yeah, George W. Bush certainly did. And, you know, I would point out that I didn't see Mitch McConnell complaining about it back then. You know, so that's where some of this partisanship comes into play, even when it shouldn't. You know, so it certainly has been used. And that came out today in argument that, you know, really what we're talking about are sort of political maneuverings, manipulation of the rules. And both parties are definitely guilty of it. You know, when George W. Bush was the president and Democrats had the Senate, they did the same thing to try to stymie Bush's recess appointment power. But, you know, I think it's important to look at the Constitution and the idea that the recess appointment power was given to the president by the framers to ensure that he or she can fulfill the obligation to faithfully execute the laws and make sure that the government is fully staffed and running. And that's the purpose. It can certainly, you know, be politically manipulated from time to time, but I think for the Supreme Court to wholly undercut the recess appointment power just because of, you know, some of the obstruction and intransigence that we're seeing right now in the appointments process would be really damaging to the country and to the balance of power that our Constitution sets up.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and was in the Supreme Court today for the 90-minute oral arguments where Republican Mitch McConnell was president and made an argument to take away President Obama's ability to do recess appointments. In this case, members to the National Labor Relations Board in a suit that was brought by a beverage bottler, from Washington State, made its way through the Court of Appeals, the very court that the president has not been able to get people on, right? I mean, it all seems to me to be so obvious that the courts are being used here as a political weapon.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's important to take the long view on these things. You know, Mitch McConnell might really regret coming into court and saying that the president doesn't have this authority in the face of a Senate that uses these pro forma sessions to avoid letting the president put any of his people on the bench and in agencies because, you know, times could change and you might see a Republican president and a Democratic Senate, and then he'll probably be sorry that he came into court and made these points. You know, but I think what's important to remember is that if the Noel Canning, the bottling company's argument is accepted, it could call into question the constitutional legitimacy, not just of these particular nominations of President Obama's to the National Labor Relations Board, but it could call into question the constitutional legitimacy of thousands of appointments going back to the founding. And I think that, you know, no matter how much Republicans dislike this president and want to upset his agenda, I think that it really, they should think twice before upsetting an equilibrium that has been the stable equilibrium reached between the political branches for many decades, if not more than 100 years.
Well, we know that the Republicans, and at the behest of the banking lobby, have fought tooth and nail to stop the appointment of Richard Cordray and to scuttle the new Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which they have, you know, clearly gone to war against. And Cordray was appointed under a recess appointment because they were filibustering him. So what's the fate of that then, that appointment? That's a really key one.
Absolutely. You know, it's not just, we're not just talking about the National Labor Relations Board, which itself is very important because it helps protect against unsafe and illegal workplace conditions. But as you said, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, was a recess appointment. And because a lot of the powers that go to the CFPB are held by the CFPB's director, Richard Cordray, you know, a whole host of rulemaking and enforcement actions that are meant to protect against some of the shenanigans that got us into the crisis that we have found ourselves, those could be placed into question as well. So I think that we need to recognize not just the sort of historical and much broader constitutional consequences here, but the fact that very important consumer and worker protections could be placed in the balance if the court rules against the Obama administration in this case.
Well, we know that the court is capable of naked partisanship, which they, in the case of Bush v. Gore, they barely dressed up with the pretense of legalism. And I'm just wondering whether this is really naked partisanship in the sense that both of these cases, the issue is a big one, recess appointments, but the specific cases of both of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and Richard Cordray and the National Labor Relations Board, both have been targets of corporate and banking interests. And a lot of these Supreme Court justices are corporatists. In the confirmation hearings, nobody ever asks them, you know, they want to know about their position on abortion, but not on whether they're corporatists or not. And many of them come out of corporate law. So I'm wondering, is that a subtext? Am I being too cynical here? I mean, it seems to me that this could be a win for corporate America.
Well, so precisely to your point, the bottling company that is raising the challenge to these recess appointments is directly represented by the Chamber of Commerce, which is sort of the litigating arm of business interests in the country. So, you know, this is definitely something that is very high up on the agenda for big business in the courts in the United States. And I think that, you know, not all of the justices are skeptical of the administration's recess appointments because of sympathy to the Chamber of Commerce, but, you know, certainly I don't think that can be discounted entirely because, as we've seen in my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center has documented the extraordinary success of the Chamber of Commerce in the Roberts Court and the great sympathy that a majority of the justices in the Roberts Court have for corporate arguments.
So, Elizabeth Wider, again, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. The history of the Constitution has been very much at play in this case, has it not, where various legal scholars on both on the progressive and the conservative side have used history to buttress their arguments. What's your analysis of where that stands?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting, especially for law nerds like me, you know, it's really fascinating to see the Solicitor General of the United States get up before the Supreme Court and quote chapter and verse from the Federalist Papers, arguing about the president's authority. And here what we have are practices which are the nomination when the Senate is in recess of important executive and judicial positions that go back to President Washington that were debated by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson thought about this precise issue and, you know, determined that the Constitution's text allowed the president to fill vacancies in the way that President Obama has done here, because there are several complicated issues before the Supreme Court in this case. One is, what exactly is a recess? Is it only the one that happens between sessions of Congress, or breaks that occur while Congress is in session? Two, can the president appoint nominees if the vacancy has existed prior to the recess? Or if, you know, the alternative view would be if, you know, the Senate is in recess and, you know, a judge dies during the recess. And that broader view has been the settled practice since the very beginnings of the nation. So when you look at the Constitution's text and you look at the way that our framers actually acted based on that text, you have a really strong argument supporting the Obama administration. And so for the court to find the other way would not just write the constitutional recess appointment power out of our founding document, but it would go against more than 200 years of practice. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, and the Solicitor General did a great job of really bringing that point home to the court and explaining that the purpose of giving the president this recess appointment power was to make sure that our nation would be up and running 24/7. That's the job of the president and the executive branch, as contrasted with, as our framers noted, Congress, which would from time to time go into recess and not be conducting business.
Well, when the Chief Justice John Roberts noted that recess appointment clause is not supposed to be a way for presidents to avoid Senate approval because of their political opposition to the appointments, you know, he said the senators have an absolute right not to confirm nominees. I don't think he can take this out of the context of this particular Senate, where you, and with this particular minority led by Mitch McConnell, who made arguments before the Supreme Court today. I mean, he has literally blocked everything. They have artificially created this threshold, filibuster threshold, for every vote on almost anything. So they have proactively changed the rules, which have forced now the Senate to change the rules back to business as usual, even though it was called the nuclear option, which, of course, was a very stupid way to frame it, because there's nothing nuclear and apocalyptic about it. It's merely going back to the way things used to be, when you had to do a real filibuster and have some skin in the game. So I can't, to my mind, you can't take this out of that context. So here you have the Republicans throwing up the roadblocks, and now the Senate has been forced to take these roadblocks away, and now they're coming in the back door saying, and by the way, in order to get around these roadblocks, you put up recess appointments, and now we're going to take them away from you.
Yeah, you know, the level of obstruction is truly unprecedented, and I think that's what's really concerning about the possibility of a ruling that would undermine the recess appointment power. You know, if Republicans took the Senate back in the next election and decided during the President Obama's remaining part of his term not to confirm any of his nominees, no matter how non-controversial they might truly be, that's a real problem for the functioning of the government. And I suppose that's entirely their point, is that they do want to hamstring the federal government from actually working. But that's not what the framers intended when they gave the president the appointment power. Chief Justice Roberts is right that the Senate does have the option of not consenting to the president's nominees. But the Constitution also, because the framers were concerned that the government be able to function and that it be able to be fully staffed, it gave the president the power to put people into these positions that need to be filled when the Senate is not around, is not available to give its consent. And so I think that you have these two competing interests on the part of the Senate and the president, and the Constitution took those into account and said that the recess appointment power is going to be one tool that the president will have in the toolbox to ensure that the executive is able to be up and running at all times.
So just in closing then, Elizabeth Wydra, if the Republicans win back the Senate in this election year in November, what would the consequences be then? You'd have the filibuster rule that was just changed by the Republicans would then be in their hands. If this Supreme Court rules in their favor, I believe in June, is it not, then the president essentially won't be able to appoint anybody, right, for the rest of his term.
Yeah, and you could get into real trouble with that. You know, as we saw with the National Labor Relations Board, this is an incredibly important executive agency. It handles matters regarding workers' rights to improve their workplace conditions, wages, and they were essentially unable to do that work because they did not have enough members on the board. They didn't have a quorum, and without these recess appointments, it's hard to see how the president would have been able to ensure that important executive agency was able to function properly. And that's really something that should be concerning because, you know, it's one thing to disagree with a member of an opposing party, and it's another to absolutely hamstring and stymie the running of the federal government. You know, that to me is something that's an entirely different flavor, and I think that's something that we should be concerned about in this recess appointments clause case.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeal. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Supreme Court taking up a case to stop predatory vulture funds from collecting Argentina's debt. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric LeCompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relationship to the international debt crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric LeCompte.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And we were just hearing about the Supreme Court today, hearing arguments on whether or not to take away the president's and all presidents' authority to do recess appointments. And that, of course, is disturbing a lot of people. But apparently there's some good news in the sense that the Supreme Court has decided to hear Argentina's objection to predatory hedge funds targeting Argentine assets outside of the United States. So fill us in on that, if you will, Eric.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. It's certainly been a ping-pong match of a case in the U.S. legal system. The case is between a group of hedge funds in Argentina. It goes back to when Argentina had defaulted on its debt back in 2001. It was a major default, and Argentina settled its debts with about 93% of its creditors, of its bondholders. There's been a small group of holdout of creditors that have been led by the hedge fund NML Capital. And what this hedge fund and hedge funds like it do, there's only a very small group of them, is they go after countries that are facing financial distresses, that are dealing with significant economic or poverty issues, and they try to buy up their debt, often doing so for pennies on the dollar. And then when a country is in recovery or when it might have new assets that it could use to deal with poverty in its country, groups like NML Capital and predatory hedge funds buy up the debt for pennies on the dollar, and then they resell, or rather they litigate, in order to try and collect in the debts in full. And so what's happening right now with the U.S. Supreme Court is that the Supreme Court has agreed to look at a lower court's ruling that would allow the hedge funds to get information on where Argentina's assets are around the world. In the last year, these hedge funds have tried to seize Argentine assets, including a naval ship called the Libertad, which it was sailing around the world in research and educational missions. And so what these hedge funds, you know, are trying to do is to exploit the country of Argentina. But the issue is that this case impacts more than just Argentina. This particular case impacts some of the poorest countries in the world. So it's exciting that the Supreme Court is going to take the case and look at it and is concerned with the behavior of these predatory hedge funds. It should be noted that this is only a small part of a much larger case that the Supreme Court will be facing over the next few months, and that's actually whether or not it's legitimate for these kinds of hedge funds to try and collect from Argentina. So we expect that Argentina and these hedge funds will also have another opportunity in front of the Supreme Court to talk about these issues.
And Eric Lecompte, you're joining the IMF, or your organization, Jubilee USA, is joining the IMF, the World Bank, and the White House in denouncing these hedge funds, these so-called vulture funds, collecting on the debts from the world's poorest nations. The second U.S. Second Circuit Court ruling is the one that the Supreme Court are looking into. They've ordered Argentina to pay $1.33 billion. So why, given the conservative nature of this court and particularly the corporatist nature of this court, given Roberts and Alito and many of the justices come out of corporate law, what leads you to feel that they might rule in the right direction?
Well, we have to understand that these particular issues deal with core U.S. policy in terms of how historically we've dealt with the debts of other nations, and also a core part of U.S. foreign policy around the sovereignty of countries and respecting the rights and sovereignty of other countries. I suspect that's why the Supreme Court has decided to look at one aspect of this case right now, because they're very concerned about whether or not the rights of Argentina and other sovereigns will be violated by the actions of these hedge funds. So I think that sovereignty question is a very important question, and I think it's one that the Supreme Court's going to look at very seriously as it decides to look at further aspects of the Argentina case. I think the other piece is around this issue of how the United States government has dealt with debt. You know, it's interesting. Right now, the efforts of Jubilee USA and our work on international debt relief and responsible lending and borrowing, these are considered by Congressional Quarterly to be the last legitimate bipartisan issues on Capitol Hill. So we've had more than a decade of Republicans and Democrats coming together in Washington on behalf of wanting to restructure debts of the world's poorest countries in order to give poor people a fighting chance. So with this in mind as well, you know, it's also very clear that the Supreme Court will want to look at it. I think one final piece which is worth mentioning, you know, Ian, you noted, you know, how a broad swath of groups and organizations are together on the side of Argentina and working against the hedge funds. That includes the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the U.S. government, religious groups like ours, Jubilee USA, and it also includes legitimate Wall Street investors. The reality is that this behavior of a small group of predatory hedge funds, also known as vulture funds, actually takes business away from other legitimate Wall Street brokerage houses. So it, what's amazing right now is this behavior is so extreme that, you know, we believe the Supreme Court's going to look at it because it also goes against some other corporate interests.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric LeConte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. And you mentioned the sovereignty issue, which is what has got the White House and many involved in this, and that why the Supreme Court may rule in favor of Argentina. Of course, the Monroe Doctrine was born out of the U.S.'s decision to protect this hemisphere from European gunboats collecting debts. So I see the history there. But these vulture funds, for example, if they are the outliers, how have they gotten the kind of standing that they've got so far?
Well, you know, it's all about money, and it's been amazing, you know, to have the strong support of the U.S. government and the Treasury because of the amount of lobbying they've faced from these hedge funds and the lobbying firms and communications firms that represent them. The lobbying has been immense, you know, and the U.S. government, the White House, has stood up against that pressure and continued to see the behavior of these vulture funds or predatory hedge funds as extreme behavior. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that, you know, is in our favor, that the behavior is so extreme. We have to understand that in recent years, this small group of hedge funds that have engaged in this behavior, it's been extremely profitable. And so because of that, they're willing to spend quite a bit of money. You know, since the end of last year, or rather, I should say, over the course of last year, the hedge fund spent over $3 million in lobbying Congress on these particular issues. The person who is really the billionaire behind the hedge funds, Paul Singer, he's the largest single donor and organizer of donations to the GOP or the Republican Party. Also a significant donor to Democrats and the Democratic Party. So we have to understand that they have immense resources, and it's pretty amazing that you know, many of us have been able to challenge these hedge funds when they have such deep pockets.
So let's turn to another subject in the news, a subject about which you are also concerned, Eric LeComte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, which is a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Your reaction to the Pope's selection of 19 new cardinals, 16 of whom will be eligible to vote for the next pope, two of them, of course, one of them is the youngest from Haiti and another from Burkina Faso. Is this in any way, given that these are the kind of countries that these predatory vulture hedge funds go after, is this a good sign that the Pope's appointing more cardinals from the third world, the South?
Yeah, it's extremely exciting. And as you noted, Jubilee USA, you know, we were founded by churches and essentially represent almost all of the major mainstream religious institutions in the United States on these issues of debt, tax, and extreme poverty. It's also, you know, pretty interesting seeing some of the shifts, you know, our work having long been supported by the Catholic Church, but also seeing, you know, what this particular Pope has been doing and moving forward. You know, in terms of the Vulture Fund cases that we were just talking about, you know, there's no coincidence that, you know, Pope Francis led the bishops of Argentina when he was the head of the bishops there through the Argentine default. And he's very acutely aware of these kinds of financial policies and have spoken out against actors like these predatory hedge funds. In fact, Pope Francis last year went as far as to call this kind of extreme behavior savage. So, you know, the connections are very rich, and as we see that Pope Francis has now selected new leaders for the Catholic Church, these 19 new cardinals, his first, so to speak, Pope Francis cardinals that he's put into place, it's very significant because out of the 19 cardinals, 16 are young enough to vote for the next pope. And out of those 16 cardinals that Pope Francis just appointed, out of those 16 cardinals who will vote for the next pope, 9 are from the developing world. So it's very significant that Pope Francis has sent a clear message to actually build up voting power in the College of Cardinals from cardinals that are connected with poor and conflict areas around the world. Haiti, Burkina Faso, the Philippines, all of the cardinals that Pope Francis has appointed come from an understanding and a view that has been shaped by the poorest and most vulnerable people. So it's exciting, certainly, in terms of what Pope Francis has been doing and saying that the main focus of the Church, of people of faith, of people of goodwill, should be to work together to end poverty. And it's also, I think, tremendously exciting in the sense that, you know, we're seeing there being a broader and stronger representation from cardinals from the developing world, the third world, where those cardinals have seen firsthand, where they've been on the front lines of seeing the kinds of international financial policies that keep people poor. And having that kind of knowledge coming into the center of the Catholic Church leadership is exciting and impressive.
Well, I noticed that the Pope did not choose any new cardinals from the United States. And, of course, the United States has been, the U.S. Catholic Church has been beset by these sex scandals, enormous payoffs. What's your sense of that omission?
Well, you know, certainly it does say something, doesn't it? You know, when we look at most of the cardinals being appointed from Africa, Latin America, and Asia, it certainly says something. Because I think part of what this pope is saying is that, you know, those that are affected, most of the world, those that have been living in poverty, should have more of a voice and more of a seat at the table. And so we certainly recognize that, you know, as Pope Francis is making these very important shifts in the Catholic Church, you know, we're also understanding that, you know, as of right now, you know, noting that there are so many cardinals from the northern world and the developed world, that we need to create more seats at the table from the developing world.
And in terms of doctrine, you know, there's been a lot suggested that this new pope is moving the church perhaps to the left, given how much his two predecessors moved it to the right. Is there anything to that notion? Because a lot of, my understanding is a lot of the cardinals from the global south and from the third world are doctrinally quite conservative. They may be socially liberal, but doctrinally conservative.
Right. Well, and certainly I think that's true. And I think in terms of many of the issues that have been important issues for the Catholic Church, we shouldn't think that the Church has necessarily changed its opinions on every particular issue. But I think what's really important to acknowledge is that this particular pope is putting a strong emphasis on common ground and an emphasis on ending poverty. Although poverty issues and civil rights issues, human rights issues have always been important to people of faith and certainly to Catholics and certainly to the previous popes, the popes prior to Pope Francis, I think what the difference is, it's the emphasis, that there's a strong day-to-day emphasis. This new Pope Francis doesn't seem to take any action that is disconnected from a message of common ground and ending poverty, where those messages necessarily weren't emphasized in prior papacies. So I think what we're seeing with Pope Francis is a particular emphasis on working to end poverty and working to find common ground.
Well, Eric LeConte, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Eric LeCompte, who's the director of the Jubilee USA Network, a coalition of 75 religious, policy, labor, relief, environmental, and human rights organizations advocating for solutions to the international debt crisis. Jubilee USA Network has won critical global financial reforms and more than $130 billion in debt relief for the world's poorest countries so the money could be reinvested in social infrastructure. He currently focuses on development in relationship to the international debt crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what everyone needs to know about cybersecurity and cyber war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Singer, the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of several books and articles, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution, and Conflict in the 21st Century. And his latest book, co-authored with Alan Friedman, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Singer.
Thanks for having me.
And as a result of the Edward Snowden revelations, there's been a lot of pushback from the tech giants in the United States. They took out full-page ads, and then they met in the White House. And apparently there's been some blowback against these NSA revelations about the NSA's activities that's affected U.S. business. And I'm sort of surprised in a way that the public are sort of outraged about the government snooping on them. But at the same time, these tech giants are able to gather all of their private information and commodify individuals and make profit out of individuals without the individuals getting a piece of the action.
The companies are mad about sort of two things that were going on here. One was the way that they were obliged on the front end to turn over information, cooperate with the NSA, but couldn't talk about it. And so we're put in a really difficult position when these revelations came out. And I say couldn't talk about it, legally couldn't talk about it. But in turn, what really sent them through the roof was not the original sort of PRISM revelations, but what came a couple months later, which was the backdoor vacuuming up of data, the backdoor going after some of the key lines of transmission. Essentially, that was where these companies felt taken advantage of. And really a way of thinking about, you know, why are they so mad? Well, they're companies. They have a profit interest. And it depends on the study. One study found that they've lost roughly, that they'll lose $35 billion worth of revenue. Another one from Forrester Research said that they'll lose as much as $180 billion worth of revenue. In either case, it's not a good situation for these tech companies, and that's why they're angry about it. That's different than the discourse that's been surrounding Snowden in terms of the rights question, the Fourth Amendment issues, the personal privacy, the question of involvement of U.S. citizens and intelligence collection activities. And that's really, you know, when we talk about Snowden, there's so much has been revealed that it falls into very different categories of activities and very different categories of concern. We haven't even gotten to the targeting of foreign leaders, which, you know, is not, doesn't fall in these categories. It's different, you know, the Angela Merkel side too. So then you say, you know, why is the public upset about this versus the gathering information on them by companies? Well, it goes back to very original, concerns that Americans have on their rights. You know, the questions of why do you need a warrant, that's not a recent Snowden issue. You know, that's something the founding fathers wrestled with, and that to me is, you know, at the nature of this are some certain deep concerns about the political role of government and how far can that go versus questions of privacy. But you've hit it right. You know, anyone who thinks that companies aren't equally interested in gathering information about you, yes, they are, but they don't have the ability, for example, to legally compel a company, another company, to share that information the way, for example, the NSA was able to do so. And they don't have the technical capability to pull off some of the activities, for example, the backdoor going after Google and Yahoo, et cetera.
So I suppose, you know, there is a line between government activity and criminal activity. But it seems to me that so much of what goes on the Internet, both in terms of communication and commerce and then obviously conflict, which is another aspect of your new book, Cyber War. But just starting with cybersecurity, and we now have this revelation about all of the people that went to Target, the big store Target, and how much their data's gone. So you have, on the one hand, the NSA snooping into the cloud-based data of all of these big giants, and they put them in these cloud-based data with the assurances that the information is secure, but they're not secure from the government. And then you've got, I take it, a bunch of criminals hacking in to get people's credit cards. So where is the line between legality and illegality with similar actions? And that's not to mention people like the Syrian Electronic Army, the KGB, or the Russians' use of hackers, the Chinese use of the 50 Cent hackers, etc. So let's start with that part first.
I think there's three ways to come at this. The first is just the simple fact that there is no issue that has become more important. And when I say more important to everything from your personal concerns of privacy to the constitutional questions of privacy to the personal protection of your bank account to now corporate issues to the political questions, you name it. There's no issue that's become more important more rapidly that's less understood than cybersecurity and cyber war. Simply put, it's just this area that we have an incredible amount of mystery, ignorance, misperception, just everything coming together. And even when people understand the technical side, the notion, you know, that the IT crowd can handle this, guess what? It ripples out into other areas, whether, again, it's on, you know, legal questions, ethical questions, to just what can you do to protect your kids? So there's no issue that's worst dealt with right now out in our public debate, and also just, you know, how we protect ourselves. And that's frankly what drove me in the writing of the book. The second is you bundled together all of these different actors, and that's again when we try and make these, you know, nice, strict, easy to understand divisions, or we bundle things together, it's a mistake because it doesn't reflect the way the internet is. Guess what? The internet, the players on it, you know, they range from the more than 100 state military entities that are building, you know, cyber command equivalents, not just in the U.S., but over 100 different nations. But they also include other civilian government agencies from the federal, the state, the local level. You know, L.A. even has built up this cybersecurity center. To corporations, you know, everything from large corporations like your Googles to small cupcake stores have a presence online. Collectives of people that come together online to engage in some kind of hacking activity, a la Anonymous, to collectives of people that gather online to share cute cat videos, to, again, individuals, you know, you, I, we have roles, we have responsibilities in this place. So we bundled together these actors, and, you know, yes, they're all online, but they're engaged in very different kinds of activities. And then you hit it exactly right, where, you know, the types of things that have popped up in the news recently, you know, they range from NSA to the Target hack to, you know, the opposite end, Neiman Marcus got hacked. So, you know, maybe the rich person doesn't have to worry, but their personal shopper better darn well be worried about this. And yet we put these together with things like Cyber 9/11, Cyber Pearl Harbor. We bundle together unlike things simply because they're all in the realm of zeros and ones. And we would never do that with the chemistry of gunpowder. We would never say a mugger, a terrorist, a kid with a firework, a political protester with a smoke bomb, a nation with a cruise missile. We would never say, well, these are all the same because they use the chemistry of gunpowder. But we do the same on cyber. We lump them all together. And again, I think it reflects that first point that I was making of how we don't well understand these issues right now, the basics of them, and how we all collectively need to get, frankly, a lot smarter on it.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Singer, who's the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He is the author of several books and articles, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and the Conflict in the 21st Century. And his latest book, co-authored with Alan Friedman, is Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. But to the extent that there's been a revolution in the national security arena and the landscape, where since the end of the Cold War, national threats have disappeared almost entirely, where subnational and transnational threats have taken over. So we've had to rethink that idea of borders and over there, going back to World War One, that doesn't exist anymore. So since everybody uses this same internet for both warfare and commerce, is it equally borderless?
Give you a yes and no answer to that. So on one hand, we've seen the development of weapons that are like every other weapon in human history. They cause some kind of physical damage, whether it's a stone or a drone. But because they are no longer a thing, because they're made of software, made of, you know, zeros and ones. Stuxnet was not a physical thing. It caused physical damage. Stuxnet was the cyber weapon designed to sabotage Iranian nuclear research. It was both here, there, everywhere, and nowhere. And that's something we haven't seen in weapons and warfare before. It was designed to sabotage Iranian nuclear research. It did so, but it also popped up in everything from the computers of the Indian space program to it was actually discovered because it popped up in computers in Europe. It was all over the place. And that's where we see one of the connections with some of the other new kinds of warfare out there, like, for example, the greater use of drones, where the action can be taking place, the physical damage can be taking place somewhere different than where the people who sent it are at. So there's some links, there's some differences. Now, when it comes to thinking about the roles and responsibilities, let's move beyond the technology, the weapon itself, but kind of the roles and responsibilities, there's been a narrative pushed by some folks online who say, you know, this is borderless. And in fact, this is something that states should have no role in. And states, get out of this realm. You're aspects of some dated age. And there was even a famous, you know, declaration of independence, so to speak, within the internet. It's a noble sentiment. And there's some very worrisome things that states are doing to, you know, frankly, poison the well that's been so good to us. But at the end of the day, states have to play a role in this space because they have certain responsibilities as governments. One is that they use these networks. You know, 98% of U.S. military communications go over the internet, so it has that direct concern. But then they have the secondary, the next layer to this, which is their responsibility for the safety and security of their citizens, which again depends on the online world working effectively. You know, whether it's your communications, your commerce, your power infrastructure, you name it. So there is a role for states. We can't think of this as a stateless realm, but we also have to understand that it's fundamentally different than some of the things we've assumed in some of our structures that were built up in, say, the 20th century.
Well, just in the last minute then, Peter Singer, you mentioned drones, and drones elicit a lot of outrage and passion amongst people. Most of my friends, for example, find them absolutely get, you know, steamed up in a way that's really quite extraordinary about them. And my question is, Is it better then to stick a bayonet in somebody's stomach and watch them die? Is that how warfare should be? Is that how gentlemen carry it out as opposed to zapping somebody with a drone? What's your understanding about why people find it so revolted by drones, both here in the United States and particularly in countries where they're being used against civilians?
Every time there's been a new technology in war, whether it was David picking up his sling and stone, to the first use of gunpowder, to the new technologies of today, people would describe how they weren't fair. You can go back and find a quote from a French nobleman talking about how only cowards would use a gun when the first gunpowder came around. And that's the same sort of thing that's playing up right now. That's a repeat in history. I think what makes these new technologies, whether it's drones or cyber weaponry, is that there's a concern because you're moving the human role both physically from the battle space, at least in terms of, you know, who's doing the sending of the weapon, and also the next step in robotics, as well as what's happening in cyber, is you're moving the human role chronologically. The decisions that matter might be made not in the midst of battle, but days, weeks, months beforehand. And that's troubling, I think, at the core for people in terms of our legal, our ethical, our social, our political understandings of war were built on a very different assumption. But guess what? As troubling as it is the reality of war in the modern 21st century, that it will mix, you know, both the bayonet and the cyber weapon of Stuxnet, and you better understand both of them if you care about issues of war, politics, or the like. The difference with, you know, your bayonet example with cyber is that it also involves the rest of us, because it's going over the very same networks and going after the very same targets that we all collectively use. So a weapon like Stuxnet will be traveling over the same networks that your cute cat videos will be going over.
Well, Peter Singer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess we barely scratched the surface, but I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of several books and articles, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. And his latest book, co-authored with Alan Friedman, is Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. And you can also visit his website, cybersecuritybook.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.